This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to start our show talking about something that some people maybe want to whisper about because it's life insurance, you know, betting that I'll live, or if I don't live, somebody else will at least benefit from the fact that I lived. We're going to talk about life insurance with Dan Haglund. He's with Sons of Norway Insurance in Fargo, and we're sort of hooking this to National Life Insurance Day, which is Thursday this week, among 1,500 other special days in a given year on the calendar. So it's not like we have a big X there for National Life Insurance Day, but it is probably appropriate every now and then, Dan, to talk about this form of investment.
And that's a good point you make as far as married couples. A lot of times will not talk about it with one another, but they'll feel comfortable talking about it with me or another agent simply because that's what we do and we jump right into it.
Well, what is the best argument to buy life insurance?
Well, for most people, they might have a debt. They may have minor children. They may have final expenses they need to think about. Everyone, 100% of people in history have died. except for the people that are living. So it's something that's going to happen. And so it's something that everyone should prepare for.
So it's kind of a grim reaper bet here, I take it.
Well, it's the ultimate democracy, that's for sure.
What is the business model and the financial structure that makes life insurance work?
The business model, it's like going to the doctor, and the doctor would diagnose you by asking 30 questions and doing a whole bunch of tests. Now, we have to kind of do the same thing. So there's no one answer for that. As far as an individual, say they have $1 million in assets, they make $100,000 a year. Well, I'm going to have a different answer for that person than someone who's got $100,000 and maybe $10,000 in the bank.
Well, let's talk about that second one. What would sort of the opening advice be for $100,000 and $10,000?
Again, there's 30 more questions, but I would tend to maybe suggest to them, well, what would you leave your dependents, and what would you leave people that would be alive to pay your bills? How many bills are you leaving them? Are your minor children going to want to go to college? Are there medical issues with the people that you live with? I mean, are they going to need more money? In general, I would steer those towards term life, and that's what I personally have too.
Term life as opposed to whole life. Define that for our listeners.
Whole life builds cash value. The premiums are higher. Say, for instance, it's $250,000 policy, but you're putting in a bunch every year. Or you could put in a one lump sum to begin with and then put more in later. You can customize it to your financial situation. And then what happens is when it builds cash value, you can, in essence, turn that into your personal bank if you need a loan.
Okay.
You can borrow your cash value out. And so, then you return it back in for a very low interest rate.
And the term, basically, you're just investing so much a month in a premium to pay out in the event that you expire.
Right. And for our company, we go anywhere from 10 to 30 years on term. What that means is your premium each month or each year is going to stay the exact same for all of those payments.
Until you have to renew a term.
Right.
And then do pre-existing conditions come into play?
Well, if you want to do a new term, say the end of your 30-year term is coming up, you would be then looked at your current age and your current health, and you'd be re-underwritten.
Okay.
And so they'd look at all of your new medical issues, if there are any.
So chances are it would be more.
Well, the chances are people over a 30-year period don't get better.
That's right. But we do have that terminal end.
Some do.
Okay. Now, you were with Sons of Norway Insurance, and you described that as a fraternal insurance mm-hmm. business. Describe the different kinds of business we're talking about here that sell life insurance.
Well, technically, fraternals are nonprofits. And so we can keep our premiums lower in general than the big boys, the larger companies, the New York Lifes of the world, that kind of, you know, they're 100 times, 200 times bigger than we are. We only have 50 agents in the country, so we're all face-to-face with all of our customers as opposed to just doing a giant numbers game.
So your 50 agents are being sustained by however many customers they have out there paying premiums, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And it's sort of a bet, if you will, that the Sons of Norway Insurance is saying that we'll have more customers than we have payouts, right?
Well, every company wants to go into it not to lose money.
Correct.
And so we actually do have about $360 million in assets.
Okay.
And that's our insure, that's our number of insured.
How are life insurance agents trained?
Well, I think with our 50 agents, you've got 50 stories. What did I do before I became a life insurance agent? I worked as a journalist. I had a lot of other jobs before that too. Some people have done finance their whole adult career. Others like me jumped right into it because they wanted a change. They wanted to determine what they did with their day, when they worked, how hard they worked, and how much they got reimbursed for that.
Well, let's talk about that. How are life insurance agents compensated?
In general, they're 100% commission.
So the more you sell, the more you make.
And with the bigger companies, it's not structured like that. It's structured where they get a certain amount per year. They get a salary, and then they get commission on top of that. But we're smaller. We're lean and mean, so we're just commission.
So how do you get over the natural reticence of somebody who's dealing with a salesperson who's selling them a financial product?
Well, it comes down basically to just asking questions. I'm just a professional question asker, and I'm really good at paperwork, and
okay.
That's all I do. If they want to sell themselves on something, that's up to them.
Where can consumers find objective information and or, you know, comparisons to make informed decisions about something that could be a very significant expense for them?
I think in this field and in almost any field, you go to people you know and trust, first of all, family members, professionals, people that maybe work in the industry, and you can kind of get your head around the subject before you even meet with an agent.
So it's a relationship business.
Sure. More so than almost any other business.
You mentioned some good reasons to get insurance. What are some good reasons not to avoid it?
Well, there are some people that are overinsured, and that a lot of people are they buy things maybe more than they should. You know, they don't say no. And you have to look at their picture. I have actually sat across the kitchen table with people and I said, you don't need anything. You are good. You don't need me. And I want to be able to tell some people that. You know, I don't want to sell something that they don't need. And when I see that someone has enough to cover any of their debts, and if they have minor children, generally you want to make sure that you have money to pay for them through their college years. So.
Well, years ago, I think there was a bit of a controversy in the insurance business about the idea of insuring children, you know, mm-hmm. sort of betting that if they die, mom and dad get some kind of a benefit or something.
We have a children's policy, but in general, that is for final expenses, and it's something that no one wants to talk about.
So these are children that would be facing literally a terminal illness or something
well,
like that?
Well, accidental, you know, and the reason that we get minor insurance for 17 and under is if something does come up while they are a child, they are then insurable once that term is over. We can insure them up to 3 times as much, and some companies go 5 times as much when they do turn 18, and they can't be turned down for any reason. So it's to maintain insurability.
What is the minimum income level that you would consider for somebody to look at life insurance?
We don't really have a minimum income level, but we do have a minimum premium level, which is $10 a month.
And what do I get for $10 a month on a term policy?
If you're a young, healthy person, you might be able to get – so for instance, I have a 21-year-old term life female, she has $250,000 in insurance that costs $12 a month.
Wow.
Yeah. Because her health is good and she, you know, qualified. So really you can get a lot when you're young and healthy.
So how long is that term for her?
10.
Okay.
10 years.
So 10 more years you'll have to mm-hmm. reconsider. It'd probably be more than $12 a month after that.
And then I have another one that's 25 and he's got $500,000 for $25 a month.
Wow.
You know, males actually cost a little more than females on premiums because they die earlier on average.
What's a reasonable ratio of income to premium expense when you're purchasing life insurance? I realize this can vary, but
Well, they have ratios for home purchases, and they don't want to go over 40% and, you know, in certain situations like that. And for us, I would say one day of income out of a month, you know, whatever you think that is. And that's totally dependent on the person. If they're going into it for an investment purpose, it could be a lot higher than that. It could be a lot lower than that if they just are really budgeted to the pins.
Now, you're in a competitive marketplace. Life insurance is out there with other ways of saving as well, like a 401k or an IRA or that kind of thing. How much competition is that for what you do?
Well, I think in a healthy, a healthy stock market, when things are going well, people tend to want to go where the money is flowing in. But once people get to be about 60 to 65, their risk level, or their risk tolerance, we call it, goes down quite a bit. They've built all this money up over their career, lifetime, and all of a sudden they say, you know, I don't really want to take a big hit like we did in the recession, you know, 10, 12 years ago. So then they want to maybe put their money into what we have. It's called an annuity, which is an IRA, which gives you a guaranteed interest percentage every year.
Okay. But I could do that by going through any other mutual fund too, couldn't I?
You could, sure. And mutual funds are a lot of times tied with the market.
So the difference here is that if I buy a whole life with this option, I have that that big burst of money that happens if in the event that I die.
Well, that's it too. If someone is 65 and they want to get something whole life, the interest rate's actually higher with that than it is with an annuity. So some people, if their health's good, I would steer them toward maybe getting something like that where they're going to earn more money every year.
Okay.
If their health is not so good, let's just do the annuity.
How secure and how regulated are life insurance companies?
Well, they're regulated by FINRA. And it's really we're all fiduciaries. So we have to watch over every penny of every person's money, and we get one bad mark and we're out for generally for life.
Wow.
So we don't want to steer anybody, or you know, there's a lot of different ways that people have run themselves out of the business, and we don't want to do that.
Well, we see a lot of life insurance products, especially term life insurance products, sold in the back of magazines and you know. What sorts of ways would you analyze an insurance offering?
Well, you can look at the AM Best list, which companies rise to the top if your company is high on that list, or you can do your own research by asking friends. Well, who do you go with, and how have they treated you? You know, for me, I think 3/4 of the sales come down to reputation. You know, with people that you know. And if people have had good luck with them, if they like their agent, a lot of times they'll bring more people in.
Now, is this something that absolutely has to be a deal between the agent and the person who's covered, or can you buy coverage for somebody and basically not tell them?
You should let another person know. Unless
should,
it's a
but do you have to?
That's a sticky situation. You could if there's a insurable interest, it's called. Say, for instance, an elderly man might buy insurance for his son. He doesn't necessarily have to tell him, but ideally he would. And if there's insurable interest there, if there's a relationship as far as father-son or grandparent-grandchild, then we would sell that. We would be able to sell that.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about high-risk occupations. North Dakota recently made this list of the states with the most fatalities per 100,000 people, most worker-related fatalities.
Second behind Alaska.
Just a hair behind. And, of course, the three major industries in the state are all high in terms of worker fatality rates, and that's oil and gas exploration, coal mining, and farming.
Mm-hmm.
So does the occupation play a role in how these premiums are figured
Lifestyle
out?
Lifestyle and occupation could play a role with our underwriter. We have an underwriter, one person. And so that actually does tend to play into it, but there has been a lot of business for me in the oil field area. These people, are putting their necks out, and sometimes they are a little scared of what they do. And so getting some insurance has been a good idea for them.
So it's not unusual for somebody getting into a hazardous profession to take out term insurance or some kind of insurance?
Absolutely not, because they see that, you know, they're seeing big dollars coming in. And I just tell them, you know what, you're not going to miss this premium at all, but your family would really miss your income if you're not here.
Now, what about the possibility of somebody taking out a great big life insurance policy and then driving into a bridge?
Well, there are suicide clauses. I mean, sometimes there's no payout on those, and some states have implemented a 2-year wait, you know, as far as when they start their policy versus if they are deemed to have died from suicide. So there are protections for the insurance company as well.
And if an insurance client decides to end the coverage, is there a cost or penalty?
If the insurance company decides
to? No, if the client, if I do.
Oh, no, no. A lot of times with an annuity there might be. Sometimes there's a 5 to 8 year penalty time. They might have to pay 1 or 2 or 3% of what they put in to back out of it. And that's an insurance policy for the insurance company to make sure that they keep that money in there. And then once their penalty period is over, then it's 100%. They can cash it back out.
Okay. And if I had term insurance, for example, and I did it, extended every 10 or 20 years until I got to near retirement age, and then I had this, you know, significant 401k or Roth IRA that was just waiting for me, would it be smart for me to simply end my insurance coverage?
What you could do at that point is if you have term, say you have $250,000 in term, which is really cheap as far as premiums, you could then convert it to whole life. You could turn your $250,000 term life policy into a whole life policy by funding it with the money that you just got from your 401k. You could put the whole $250,000 pile right into that.
Because it would be a much larger premium, wouldn't it? I mean, the difference between whole and term.
You could do a single premium with $250,000 and put it right in there, and then you'd have a brand new policy, really.
All right.
That would pay out even more than $250,000.
Dan Haglund is with Sons of Norway Insurance, and if you're keeping an eye on the calendar, Thursday is National Life Insurance Day. Dan, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, Harvest Public Media.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
If you would just make these endless emails disappear, O-N, show us how to fix the climate while you're here.
Ah, the weekends on Prairie Public. I mean, what could be better? Though you'd probably like to. Maybe you don't have the time to listen to Prairie Public for long periods during the week. You know, you have jobs and stuff. But you have the chance to dive deep and catch up on the weekends. Maybe you wake up to a little grammarian levity on Away With Words or laugh at the absurdity of the week's news on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I bet you have a hard time running errands because you can't get out of the car with the immersive storytelling on This American Life and Radiolab that artfully paints the human experience with sounds and words. Perhaps it's Reveal's award-winning investigative reporting, the friendly, diverse, and youthful perspectives on It's Been a Minute, fun financial and entrepreneurial stories on Planet Money and How I Built This, or maybe Saturday evenings means hearing another stellar live guest on Live From Here. We could use your help in creating more driveway moments on the weekend for you. Become a sustaining member. It's easy. Just go to prairiepublic.org. You can call 800-359-4145 or text the word support to 484848 and open the link we sent you. Thanks for loving the radio on the weekends and for supporting Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Hallucinogenic mushrooms and other substances that cause that effect were federally banned more than 40 years ago. Now a growing movement wants access to the banned mushrooms for possible medicinal applications. Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports that mushroom enthusiasts want the freedom to use them without fear of criminal prosecution.
Euphoria, hallucinations, seeing God are all side effects of psilocybin mushrooms, which people consume sometimes in a tea, as a chocolate, or in tiny doses, also called microdosing. And these mushrooms grow all over the world.
These right here, I picked like 3 days ago.
Like here, in this closet in a Denver apartment. Douglas, who didn't want to use his full name for fear of federal prosecution, holds a handful of mushrooms that he grows and sells illegally.
Mushrooms are really easygoing, especially psilocybin. You know, they kind of just grow themselves, and like this is a relatively quiet thing to do.
With his DIY setup of glass jars, large plastic bins, and a pressure cooker, Douglas can grow up to $1,000 of mushrooms per month. He learned how on the internet. Companies will even ship mushroom spores in the mail, which is legal since they don't contain psilocybin.
If you just want to start small, investment super low, you could throw $80 at it and have like an ounce to yourself.
But doing so could land you in prison, which is why a ballot measure in Denver's upcoming election asks voters to decriminalize mushrooms. Adults 21 or older who are caught with it or even growing the fungi for themselves would be a low priority for local police.
With decriminalization and stuff, I can operate a little bit more freely, have to worry less.
And it's not just Denver. A Republican lawmaker in Iowa recently proposed removing psilocybin from the state's list of controlled substances. And in Oregon, a campaign hopes to legalize it for medical use in approved clinics.
This isn't the stuff that states have any infrastructure to deal with.
Matthew Johnson has spent the last 15 years researching psychedelics at Johns Hopkins University. He says research shows this drug is not addictive, causes fewer ER visits compared to other illegal drugs, and could be used to treat a whole host of ailments, like depression. But he doesn't support increasing access in the same way some states have loosened up laws around cannabis.
You know, there are substantial risks involved with this therapy, and it needs to be done by appropriately trained and credentialed medical and psychological professionals.
Under the influence of psilocybin, people can panic and put themselves in danger. There have been fatalities.
I would hope that Denver would be very clear about, yes, there are risks, and these are the risks. There are harms that can come from this. This isn't encouragement to use.
In as little as 5 years, Johnson believes research on psilocybin will lead to the first FDA-approved medication, at which point the federal government will have to stop treating it like a dangerous drug. But until then...
Any controlled substance is a concern. It's obviously on a Schedule 1 for a reason.
Deanne Reuter is with the DEA office in Denver and says they'll continue prosecuting psilocybin cases, even though they don't see that many.
The trafficking of psilocybin seems to be like a small niche kind of community.
Like Douglas, who says he doesn't have a lot of competition and knows most of the people he sells to. And even though the Denver ballot measure wouldn't protect a dealer like him, he wants to grow more.
I'd say half of it is supplementary income, whereas the other half is like, I want to create something that people can benefit from.
He says anything that breaks down the stigma around mushrooms will be good for business. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration that reports on food and agriculture in the Midwest. Coming up on Main Street, a discussion with a financial writer about strategies to deal with the high cost of higher education and retirement. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. 2018 was a very good year in terms of taxable sales and purchases in North Dakota.
They're up about 12.5%.
Tax Commissioner Ryan Rauschenberger says that's compared to 2017. Those sales and purchases totaled $20.24 billion, compared with just under $18 billion in the previous year. The reason? Better oil prices spurring more activity in the oil patch. Rauschenberger says the price averaged around $65 a barrel.
The Bakken is very, very productive and profitable at that average $65. And I've heard from many industry members that's kind of that sweet spot of where you have decent returns, but the prices aren't so high that you start getting a backlash, for example, at the fuel pump.
Two of the state's largest cities showed a decrease in sales tax in 2018. Bismarck was down by 2.25%, while Grand Forks was down by 12.25%. The Minnesota House has rejected a transportation bill amendment to create a pilot project on the merits of taxing motorists on mileage-driven. Supporters say the study would examine funding possibilities for roads and bridges, especially with more fuel-efficient and hybrid models on the road. Critics say it's another example of government invasion of privacy by tracking where motorists drive. One estimate suggests the study would cost Minnesotans around $1 million. Here's a sample of that debate.
One is enough when taxing motor vehicles.
This is a pilot project. It's not going to require anybody to do anything that they don't want to.
We're taking $1 million out of fixing potholes is what this does.
There is a vast amount of information, personal information, that needs to be collected on you and your travels everywhere you go.
The measure was defeated 73-56. And Fargo-Cass Public Health is observing National Infant Immunization Week. The awareness campaign runs from April 27th through May 4th. Jessica Leach is immunization coordinator as well as a registered nurse. She says the annual observance of National Infant Immunization Week highlights the positive impacts of vaccination on the lives of infants and children. She says within the first year of their lives, children are vaccinated for a variety of diseases.
Infant immunizations include hepatitis B, rotavirus, DTaP, which is going to be diphtheria, tetanus, and a cellular pertussis, Hib, pneumonia, and polio.
Leach says keeping vaccination rates high help keep create herd immunity, which protects vulnerable patients from contracting diseases. She says as a healthcare professional, she advises parents and families to speak to their healthcare providers about vaccines instead of looking them up on the internet. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
On the next Morning Edition, Democrats say the Attorney General mishandled the release of the Mueller report.
Barr's words and actions suggest he has been disingenuous and misleading.
He testifies this week. Also, are you sure you know where all your recycled packaging goes?
It's fascinating, but it's messy.
Listen for news and stories that affect your world on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Chris Carosa. He joins us by phone from Western New York. Chris is a contributing editor to fiduciarynews.com, and he's got lots of background and information about, you know, saving for retirement and saving for higher education and all that kind of stuff. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thank you. Tell our listeners a bit about yourself. How would you describe your work to our listeners?
I'm what some people have called a parallel entrepreneur. I have many different things that I do, many different businesses. One of my favorite things is writing books and writing books that help people learn how to save for retirement. That's my latest book, From Cradle to Retirement, The Child IRA, talks about that. I also have an investment management firm, so I know a little bit about the financial business, but I'm really here to talk more about the books than that.
Well, let's talk about the books and about saving for retirement and for saving for higher education. We'll begin with that kid getting through college kind of thing. How serious is the current level of student debt in the United States?
It's pretty serious. I'm just going through this with my kids and reflecting on how much debt I had when I graduated in 1982 and how amazingly little it was compared to them. But then again, tuition was a lot lower back then. So we've had an acceleration, a massive inflation in tuition costs, and that's really reflected now in the loans that the kids have to take out in order to go to school.
Well, when I went to school and I graduated about a decade before you did, literally without debt, and I was going to a public college and then a public university, and frankly, tuition and books and living expenses were a fraction of what they are now. So how much more can families bear in terms of the rising arc in costs for higher ed?
That's an important question. I think really it comes down to an economic question. This is kind of off topic from what I normally talk about, but it's economics still, so it's an area that I'm a little bit immersed in. And I think that you have to look at how student loans are set up and who is on the hook for those student loans, and why there's no incentive right now to cut those student loans down. And when I say there's no incentive, parents and students want to go to college. They want to get that degree. It's something that's going to help them in the future. And so they're motivated to do it, and they're willing to pay almost any cost to get that degree. Therein lies the problem. Who determines the cost? The college determines the cost. So in the simple supply and demand curve, as long as the demand is there, colleges can continue to charge higher and higher prices, and that's precisely what we've seen. And in turn, that's led to the debt, because regular people pretty much can't afford to pay for college right now.
Well, that is the kind of the nut of this problem. Are we at the wall? I mean, are we at the point where people are just going to forego higher education? Because it's like assuming a mortgage on a house when you graduate.
I think we started to see this trend occur maybe about 10 years ago. Certainly you have well-known people like Mike Rowe who make the case that, you know, college isn't really that necessary to get the kind of job that can pay you halfway decent. Not just at the micro kind of dirty jobs level, but also I think there was a push maybe about half a dozen years ago in Silicon Valley where they tried to attract students. In fact, they lured students, high school students, away from college to go work directly for Silicon Valley companies. In fact, the valedictorian of my daughter's class did precisely that, and he's certainly doing quite well without a college degree.
Okay. Well, let's do a little planning, though, for those parents out there with kids who are looking at higher education. How can parents best prepare for the cost that's inevitable down the road? If you've got a baby now, what should you be doing?
Well, I think that the most popular thing that people are doing right now are setting up 529 plans. 529 plans are college savings programs on a state-by-state basis. Each state has its own version of a 529 plan, but you're not required to use the plan in your state or use the plan in the state where the college will eventually be. Obviously, you can't because you don't know what college your child's going to go to. But you use this, and the advantage of the 529 plans is that anybody can contribute to them. So parents, grandparents, friends, neighbors, whoever can contribute the name in the, into the child 529 plan. The drawback is, I mean, what if the child is one of those blessed children who are athletically talented and get a full scholarship? Well, now you have all this money in a 529 plan that the child doesn't need anymore. Technically, you can figure out a way maybe to push it down to another child. And that's why a lot of these 529 plans aren't in the children's names, but they're in the parent's name. This way the parent can use it for any child that would need it. But still, you have that issue. What if you don't really need the money? So there's an alternative way to do it. You can't save as much, but you have a lot more flexibility and actually maybe a lot more variety, and that's through a Roth IRA. A Roth IRA is like a regular IRA, except you don't get the tax deduction and you don't pay taxes when you take the money out. You're allowed to take the money out for education, and certainly the money that you contribute into it, you can use that. So it gives you a source for payment of college tuition and room and board. But if you don't need it, then it can continue to accumulate and you'll use it in retirement. And in the book, From Cradle to Retirement, when I talk about the child IRA, I mention how really valuable this compounding over decades becomes, even for little children. And if you think about it, the example that I gave in the book is for a newborn baby. Newborn baby saves about $20 a week, and that's about $1,000 a year until they go to college, and then does nothing. Does nothing at that, puts it into a child IRA. When the baby retires at age 70, which is probably going to be the age that current babies retire at, that child IRA is going to be worth more than $2 million.
Wow.
That assumes, by the way, that you earn 2-3% less than the average return.
So, but the child IRA isn't out there. The 529 plan is. Can you start an IRA plan and then just sign it over to somebody when they become an adult, or how can you do that?
Well, the way it works, believe it or not, there's no lower age limit on establishing an IRA. So a child IRA is just like an adult IRA.
Ah.
It's for a child, and what that means is that a parent or guardian needs to sign for it. The child cannot sign for the IRA. Children below the age of 18 are not allowed to enter into contracts and this would be considered a contract, even though it's your account.
So it does sound like it's a better option than a 529 plan, though, right?
Well, there are certainly advantages of it. A couple weeks ago, I wrote an article for Forbes.com comparing the 529 plan with a Roth IRA, and it gave you a list of things that you might want to look at to see which one is better for you. But it's kind of like what I was saying now. You know, if you have a lot of money that you want to put into it, then maybe a 529 plan will allow you to do that. If you're concerned that, like, if you only have one child and you don't know if the child's going to need the money, then maybe a Roth is better. So there's a number of factors that are a little personal, and, you know, there's no one-size-fits-all in this thing.
Well, let's talk about some policy ideas that are in the news these days. One is free college for all. Elizabeth Warren has also unveiled a proposal to make college more affordable, basically wiping out student loan debt for households with a certain level of income. How realistic are these approaches from your perspective?
Well, let me take a look at it from two different ways, because there's really two different proposals here. One is free college for all, which we have on a very limited basis in New York State. As an employer, I really would be hesitant to hire somebody who didn't pay for their college. And I don't mean this when I say didn't pay for it. They could earn a scholarship, a merit-based scholarship, and that tells me that that person can do well because it's a merit-based scholarship. Athletic scholarships, same thing. There's a requirement in terms of athletics, a discipline that you're going to have to maintain. That's good. That's things that employers look. Financial aid now gets a little dicey, but it's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing because most current financial aid programs require some input from the student or the student's family. And again, the ability to marshal those assets is something that an employer would like to see. For a student just to be given the money carte blanche with really no restrictions at all, you know, a free ride, if you will, that's where employers maybe will say, well, wait a second, do I know whether or not the student is really going to be diligent enough, the kind of person that I want to employ? So from an employer standpoint, free college maybe isn't as attractive as it sounds from the student standpoint.
Well, it was certainly attractive from my position when I was paying peanuts, you know, like $100 or $200 a quarter for my college tuition and other expenses. So it is kind of a policy issue here, too, particularly for a public college or university, that how much tuition should be charged, should be participating.
Yeah, I'll give you an answer, again, going back to New York State, how they solved this in the 60s, believe it or not. But then they dropped it. You can, again, it comes down to what we were talking about before, the costs of college, the actual cost, the infrastructure costs, the employee costs for the college itself. And those have to be passed on eventually to the students. So what if you figure out a way to reduce those costs? In the 1960s, the New York State public education, public university system began offering 4-credit courses through a couple of different PBS stations, one in Albany and one in Buffalo. And I was living in Buffalo, and I didn't take those because I think I was only 8 years old when it was out. But it was about astronomy. And it was an actual professor, a college class. You earn credit for it, but it was available for the public. Now, it cost money in order for you to actually get that credit, which, you know, I didn't do. But the crazy thing is, I became a physics and astronomy major as an undergraduate because of that class, not through New York State public universities, but still, the idea was there. They were only paying a few dollars for those credits, and it was spread out across an entire state. So there's a way to get college costs down so that they are affordable. It involves this sort of like huge internet delivery system that's growing out there, just not as recognized as much. And unfortunately, you know, New York State was on the leading edge of that and then just dropped the ball for some reason. I don't know. I was a teenager. I wasn't paying attention.
You mentioned also this other option that some families are kind of looking at, you know, with a hope and a prayer, if you will, that you know, supporting their kids' athletic interests with the hopes that ultimately they'll get skilled enough to get a scholarship. That's not very realistic, is it?
No, there was a story in the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago that talked about the number of parents who really were betting the farm that their kids would get this scholarship. And the scholarships are not as prevalent as you might think. But yet we have entire communities sending their kids to these youth sports camps, you know, for the entire... In fact, it's taking their lives away from normal kid activities and just having them focus on a single sport in hopes of getting this scholarship, only to be disappointed when it comes time to go to college. And I think, you know, the amount of money that it costs for these travel leagues, I'm not talking about Little League that you just go and almost like a community league. Those are fine. You know, I'm talking about the travel leagues where you have to put in a lot of money and take yourselves out of your community to go all over the place to play the sport. The amount of money that that costs, if there was a way for the kids to put that into a child IRA, it would be worth a lot more than really the college education. I mean, because, again, going back to the example that I gave, where a child IRA can produce a couple million dollars without doing much, you know, that's a really big head start when it comes to retirement. And, you know, what's the whole point of going to college? The whole point of going to college is to get a good job so you can earn enough, so you can save enough to retire. You know, so why not really just focus on the end result from the very beginning rather than, you know, all the middle parts in between?
Okay, but in the event that you graduate from college with a degree in, for example, nursing or teaching or law or whatever, and you've got this significant debt, there are some states, some industries that are offering some student debt relief in return for you working for them, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's another – there was another Wall Street Journal story that talked about that. And that just makes sense. This just makes sense. Again, you're talking about from the point of view of drawing in more workers to your state or higher-level workers or specific types of industry workers, you're going to lure them in any way you can. And so states are starting to do this. And I'll tell you, it's more than states. Companies are also starting to figure out ways to – kind of address their employees' student loan situation. I know I'm aware of certain 401k plans which will allow, you know how in a 401k plan you could put money automatically into your retirement account? Some companies now are allowing you to do that to pay off your student debt. And it's, I think that you might see that more and more as a greater bulk of the workforce comes into their jobs with this burden of debt. They're going to go to the jobs that are going to help them best pay down that debt, not just through the salary, but through these other programs.
Well, there are other ways to do this, too. I suppose you can join the military. They'll help you out with their debts, maybe AmeriCorps, do some sort of a service sort of option as well. But I do see in the newspaper, for example, hospitals looking for nurses, they offer a signing bonus or some sort of other incentive to get the attention out there because nurses are in short supply in some places.
That's right. Again, it goes back to the supply and demand question. That's why if you look at the types of majors, I mean, going back to the college debt situation, you know, my son, my youngest child, is going to be a civil engineer. He's already got his job. He's going to work. He has the most debt of all my kids. But he's also got a job that's going to end up paying the most, and he'll be able to address that debt. There are other majors that are not as sought after types of jobs, and there they can accumulate hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt and really not have a realistic way to pay that debt off without undergoing some major sacrifice. So that's part of the equation, too. I mean, when we talk about let me answer you the question that you asked before, because I think this is kind of a cool answer. And that had to do with paying off the debt or rescinding the debt, revoking the debt, paying off the debt that's already there. Mm-hmm. So this is the Elizabeth Warren proposal.
Yes.
And you know, a lot of people will say that's unfair because all these other people pay for it already. You know, why should, you know, blah, blah, blah. That's actually, well, I'm thinking this way. I'm thinking, you know, this is actually an opportunity, could be an opportunity to kind of rejigger how these incentives are going. So if the debt is, you know, forgiven, who's going to pay for that? So right now, who's on the hook for that debt? Right now, it's either the government or it's in private institutions, banks, that are on the hook. They're the ones who gave the students the money. So if you forgive the debt, then the government or the banks are out of the money. Who benefited from that? Well, it's the colleges who benefited from that. So what if the government says, all right, we'll forgive this debt as long as the college pays us back?
Well, let's talk about the role of parents. You've talked about your family and the preparedness of your kids for higher education and all that. Parents need to model behaviors that result in financial security, don't they? Let's look at the country as a whole. How prepared is the adult population of the United States for retirement?
Ooh, that's amazing how a number of people just, if you look at surveys, a number of people just say they're not prepared. They're afraid of it. It's an unknown. But that's the bad news. The good news is, if you survey people who are already retired, they're a little bit more happy than what you'd expect. Part of the reason has to do with the fact that the people who are already retired know what it's like to be retired. So they don't have that kind of fear of the unknown that people who aren't retired currently have. So that's part of the equation, but that's only a small part of it. There still is a real problem with regards to people getting ready for retirement. Clearly, they're not saving enough for a number of reasons, and that needs to be addressed. Part of what I discovered in writing the book From Cradle to Retirement was that when people set up child IRAs, when parents set up child IRAs for their children, it taught their children the importance of savings, sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly. In the people that I interviewed, in one case, at least one case, probably a lot more, the kids, because I interviewed the kids now who are adults. Parents set up child IRAs for them when they were younger. They're now adults, and what they said is, we learned to live frugally because that's the way our parents lived. Mm-hmm. We didn't spend on anything, on everything, and we had no desire to do that because our parents taught us by example how to live. And I think that's a really important factor that maybe isn't getting as much play as it should be getting.
Well, we're going to have to leave it with that, but I thank you for reminding us of our responsibility to prepare for the future and for our kids' futures as well. Chris Carosa is the chief contributing editor to FiduciaryNews.com. Thanks for being with us today, Chris.
Thanks, Doug.
Decoded 8 Book is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Radisson Hotel in downtown Bismarck, featuring a Mother's Day brunch. Sunday, May 12th from 9 a.m. to 1:30 p.m., including prime rib, salmon, crab cakes, and much more. Reservations available by phone at 701-255-6000.
Dakota Stage of Bismarck presents Noises Off, a fond look at the follies of theater folk whose out-of-control egos, memory loss, and passionate affairs turn every performance into a high-risk adventure. This play within a play captures a touring theater troupe's production behind the scenes, progressing from flubbed lines in the dress rehearsal to mounting friction between cast members in the final performance. Noises Off begins May 2nd through the 4th and the 9th through the 12th. More information and tickets available online at dakotastageltd.com or at the door.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 30th. Remembering Theodore Roosevelt, featuring the words of Roosevelt as read by Steve Stark. As the nation's trailblazer of the conservation movement during the Industrial Age, Theodore Roosevelt linked and compared the lives of the American people with the health and existence of our American forests. Arbor Day officially began on April 16, 1872. This year's 147th Arbor Day is a descendant of the original. In North Dakota, it's the first Friday in May. In 1907, Roosevelt extolled Arbor Day with a message for the nation's schoolchildren.
Arbor Day is now observed in every state in our Union, and mainly in the schools. At various times from January through December, but chiefly in the month of April, you give a day or part of a day to special exercises and perhaps to actual tree planting, in recognition of the importance of trees to us as a nation and of what they yield in adornment, comfort, and useful products to the communities in which you live. It is well that you should celebrate your Arbor Day thoughtfully, or within your lifetime the nation's need of trees will become serious. We of an older generation can get along without what we have, though with growing hardship. But in your full manhood or womanhood, you will want what nature once so bountifully supplied and man so thoughtlessly destroyed. And because of that want, you will reproach us, not for what we have used, but for what we have wasted. A people without children would face a hopeless future. A country without trees is almost as hopeless. Forests which are so used that they cannot renew themselves will soon vanish, and with them all their benefits. A true forest is not merely a storehouse full of wood, but as it were a factory of wood, and at the same time a reservoir of water. When you help to preserve our forests or plant new ones, you are acting the part of good citizens. The value of forestry deserves to be taught in the schools, which aim to make good citizens of you. If your Arbor Day exercises help you to realize what benefits each one of you receives from the forests, and how by your assistance these benefits may continue, they will serve a good end.
Today's Dakota Datebook was written and performed by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the Historical Society of North Dakota. This series with funding from the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation.
To innovate, you must first start with an idea.
Anything is possible.
An engineering college in Lima designed a giant advertising billboard that absorbs air humidity and converts it into purified water.
Hi, this is Guy Raz, host of the TED Radio Hour on NPR. I'm inviting you to join me every Sunday here on Prairie Public.
In Silicon Valley, no one even takes you seriously unless you've had two failed startups. In other words, we're raising our girls to be perfect, and we're raising our boys to be brave.
Every week, we pick a theme, and we interview some of the greatest inventors, thinkers, writers, and artists from around the world.
If you analyze the skull and crossbones and Blackbeard's other design strategies like that, it's clear he was a very, very smart designer indeed.
People who've given TED Talks on technology, entertainment, and design.
If we start now, we can be ready for the next epidemic.
We examine fresh approaches to new problems, and we explore astonishing ways of thinking.
Gilligan's Island.
Apparently, it's one long parable. That's the TED Radio Hour, every Sunday at noon Central, 11 a.m. Mountain, on Prairie Public, with me, Guy Raz.
Wednesday on Main Street, we'll talk about the social impact of genetic ancestry testing. That's the title and the subject of the annual community lecture organized by the College of Science and Mathematics at NDSU. The lecture will be delivered by Wendy Roth. She's a professor of sociology at the University of British Columbia, and she will give us a preview on Main Street on Wednesday. We hope you can join us for the show. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.